Welcome to the Bob Harden Show, bringing you news and commentary to keep you informed and enjoying life on the Paradise Coast. And now, here's your host, Bob Harden.
Good morning. Thanks so much for joining us here on the show. It's brought to you in part by the good folks at Johnson's Air Conditioning. Johnson's Air Conditioning is Naples' longest established air conditioning company. They do a great job. You can find out more by visiting the website, johnsonsairconditioning.com. Also by Life in Naples magazine, be in the know and stay up to date. By reading Life in Naples, the website is lifeinnaples.net. We have a terrific guest for today's show, including William Yateman, research fellow at the Cato Institute. We'll be talking about some of the current events that are going on in the Beltway. Michael Cannon is the director of health studies at the Cato Institute. We'll visit with Alexis Mrajcek. She's a research assistant at the Heritage Foundation. We're talking about President Biden going abroad. We'll see how he did. We'll talk about how he did. And then Dave Bigo, the author of The Devil at Our Doorstep, will be joining us as well. It is June 18th, and on this day in 1812, the first day after the Senate followed the House of Representatives in voting to declare war against Great Britain, President James Madison signed the Declaration into War, and the War of 1812 began. The American War Declaration, opposed by a sizable minority in Congress, had been called in response to the British economic blockade of France, the induction of American seamen into the British Royal Navy against their will, and the British support of Indian tribes along the Great Lakes frontier. A faction of Congress known as the War Hawks had been advocating war with Britain for several years and had not hidden their hopes that the U.S. invasion of Canada might result in significant territorial land gains for the United States. In the months after Madison proclaimed the state of war to be in effect, American forces launched a three-point invasion of Canada, all of which were decisively unsuccessful. In 1814, with Napoleon Bonaparte's French Empire collapsing, the British were able to allocate more military resources to the American war, and Washington, D.C. fell to the British in August. In Washington, British troops burned the White House, the Capitol, they burned the library, they burned other buildings in retaliation for the earlier burning of government buildings in Canada by the United States soldiers. In September, the tide of the war turned when Thomas McDonough's American naval force won a decisive victory on the Battle of Plattsburgh Bay on Lake Champlain. The invading British army was forced to retreat back into Canada. The American victory on Lake Champlain led to the conclusion of the U.S.-British peace negotiations in Belgium on December the 24th, 1814, the Treaty of Ghent was signed, formally ending the War of 1812. By the terms of the agreement, all conquered territory was to be returned, and a commission would be established to settle the boundary of the United States and Canada. British forces assailing the Gulf Coast were not informed of the treaty in the time, and on January the 8th, now this is several months, 1815, the U.S. forces under Andrew Jackson achieved the greatest victory of American war in the Battle of New Orleans. The American public heard of Jackson's victory, and the Treaty of Ghent, at approximately the same time, fostered a greater sentiment of self-confidence and shared identity throughout the young republic. Can you imagine, this is only 23 years after the Union was formed in 1789, they're going to war and burning down the significant buildings of our capital. It's amazing what we've survived. It's also the day before Juneteenth. I think that was the day that a couple years after the Emancipation Proclamation, that the news reached Galveston that the slaves had been freed. And so now it's a federal holiday. Today it's being celebrated. Federal employees get a surprise day off today because the president signed this into law. I think it's going to cost us about $600 million or something like that. Just giving the day off to federal employees makes no sense. Anyhow, it's Juneteenth. We're celebrating it today because it's happening tomorrow. It's June 19th is Juneteenth. Former President Donald Trump is planning to hold major rallies in the states of Ohio and Florida later this month. Following a series of speeches to the Republican conservatives over the past 5 months, former President Donald Trump will head to Ohio and Florida over the next 2.5 weeks to hold the kind of mass rallies with rank-and-file supporters that fueled his White House campaigns. Early reports from the New York Post indicated that Trump's rallies are intended to lay down a marker for 2024. He's expected to stage his first post-presidential rally in Cleveland, in the Cleveland area, on June the 26th, and followed up with an event in the Tampa area on July the 3rd. You probably already knew that, but it's fun to talk about. It'd be great to see him back on the stump again. You probably have also seen this, but it's worth mentioning. Mark and Patricia McCloskey both pled guilty for their roles in waving guns at protesters outside their Central West End home in the St. Louis area. Mark McCloskey pled guilty to Class C misdemeanor of fourth-degree assault. He faces a $750 fine and no jail time. Patricia McCloskey pled guilty to a Class A misdemeanor of second-degree harassment. She was fined $2,000 and will not face jail time either. They both consent to forfeit their guns to be destroyed. The couple, both of them attorneys in the early 60s, say they felt threatened after protesters broke into their iron-gated no trespassing sign. Protest leaders denied damaging the gate and said the march was peaceful. Mark McCloskey came out of his home with an AR-15-style rifle, and Pat McCloskey emerged with a semi-automatic handgun. Cell phone video captured the confrontation. Richard Callahan, a longtime judge and former U.S. attorney, was appointed special prosecutor after a judge in December ruled that circuit attorney Kim Gardner, we'll talk more about her and others who are supported and financed by George Soros, the likes of George Soros, created an appearance of impropriety by mentioning the McCloskey case in a fundraising email before August Democrat primary. Gardner went on to win the election, re-election. McCloskey is running as a Republican for the U.S. Senate. All's well that ends well. It's very disappointing that he's not off scot-free, but as he put it, he said, you know what? What they charged me with and what I'm pled guilty to, I did. I went outside and brandished my arm and tried to protect my property, and if I'd do it again, he said. This is a piece by Matt Palumbo. I've had him on the show several times back when he was with the Washington Examiner. He now writes with the Foundation for Economic Education. He says that all politics is local, and it's local politics when George Soros has the most success, unlike presidential races where even tens of millions of dollars, remember Michael Bloomberg, and spending only amount to a few percent of overall spending. Soros has been able to drown local races in cash, making it virtually impossible for anyone to compete with his desired candidate. Countless district attorneys nationwide won their races with Soros' backing, including Philadelphia's Larry Krasner, Los Angeles' George Gascon, Contra Costa County's Diane Becton, St. Louis' Kim Gardner, remember her, she was the one that was involved in the charging of the couple in St. Louis, Chicago's Kim Fox, what a disappointment she's been, Loudoun County's Bhuta Bijiraj, Portland's Mike Schmidt, what a piece of work he is. Suffolk County's Rachel Rollins, and many, many more. Soros' undermining of law and order in America at the local level is continuing in 2021, with him quietly investing $200,000 in another far-left prosecutor in Virginia this month. Soros' cash infusion, which has slipped under the radar, includes $157,000 from his Justice and Public Safety PAC and $41,500 from his Democracy PAC to Ramin Fatia, a state and federal prosecutor who won a three-way Democratic primary on June 8th, is now the only candidate on the ballot for the November general election for Norfolk's Commonwealth Attorney. So he favors lax enforcement and views crime as a symptom of structural racism. According to his campaign website, Fatia supports decriminalizing and legalizing marijuana possession, abolishing cash bail, abolishing the jury trial penalty, and make the system honor the principles that Black Lives Matter. I'm not kidding. This is what he's got on his website. Fatia explained that his twisted philosophy is a recent interview with The Appeal. The old-fashioned view about public safety was not taking into account externalities, he said. It was focused on the idea of crime as an evil unto itself. Where I part ways is that recognizes that crime is a symptom. It's a symptom of structural racism, of systematic community divestment, of redefining unequal school policy, the lack of jobs, lack of transportation, lack of opportunities, intergenerational barriers to wealth building, the divestment in the treatment of the mentally ill. He's for the little guy, I guess, is what he's trying to say. Little guy, this is, of course, this policy is completely backwards and it won't work. It just leads to greater crime. Like all progressives, Fatia bends on over backwards to create enough excuses for criminal behavior that the criminals themselves receive none of the blame. A commonality between all of Soros prosecutors he's backed is that they all treat criminals as if they're victims. He went on to complain that we put criminals in prison. It's incredibly expensive imprisoning people, jailing them, and supervising them. We are divesting them from our own community. We're pulling human capital and dollars away from things like mental health treatment, drug treatment, education, housing contracts, and so on, says Fatia. Soros is also backing a candidate in the New York City mayoral race. That would be Maya Wiley, supported by AOC. Wiley says, if we don't get together as a movement, we'll get a New York City built by and for billionaires, and we need a city for the working people. Unbelievable. So this has happened in Portland, Oregon. The Rapid Response Team, a unit with the Portland Police Department, voted unanimously to resign on Wednesday during a meeting with the police union. This follows the criminal indictment of an officer for assault stemming from a riot in August 2020, sources with the Bureau said. This officer, basically, probably have seen videos of it, I'm not sure, but he pushed someone and the person fell down and hit their head or whatever. So now this Mike Schmidt is charging that. If you can imagine this rapid response team, they've all quit. They no longer have one in Portland. So now these thugs are free to go ahead and just burn down the city or do whatever they want to do. And the sad thing, this is Mike Schmidt, this is one of these Soros guys, basically would say, hey, you know what, we had it coming. We have white fragility. We have, we're guilty as a society of so many systemic racism and all these things. They burned down the city. We had it coming. That's probably be his point of view. Sad. Thank you, George Soros, huh? Hey, this segment of the show brought to you by the good folks at Johnson's Air Conditioning, Naples' longest established air conditioning company. Visit johnsonsairconditioning.com. Also by Life in Naples magazine. Be in the know and stay up to date by reading Life in Naples. The website is lifeinnaples.net. Coming up, we're going to visit with William Yateman, research fellow at the Cato Institute. We're going to do that and more right here in the Bob Harden Show on the Bob Harden Broadcasting Network.
Stay tuned for more of the Bob Harden Show here on the Bob Harden Broadcasting Network.
I'm Bob Harden, the host of the Bob Harden Show. One of my favorites for breakfast or lunch is Lulabee's Diner, providing great service, fabulous food, and a rockin' good time. Lulabee's Diner is a throwback to the 60s, complete with great music and a fabulous 60s decor. What I like best is a blend of great food, great value, and terrific service. Most of the friendly waitstaff has been part of Lulabee's for years. I enjoy the great choices for breakfast and lunch, and you'll find the menu has everything and anything to satisfy your taste. Lulabee's offers catering, party platters, lunch boxes, and more. Lulabee's Diner will quickly become one of your favorites for breakfast or lunch. No reservations are needed. Check out the website at lulabees.com and stop by Lulabee's Diner, open from 8 a.m. until 2 p.m. 7 days a week. Lulabee's Diner in the Green Tree Shopping Center at the corner of Immokalee and Airport Pulling Roads. Stop by Lulabee's Diner for fabulous food and for a forever cool rockin' good time. Did you know St. Matthew's House operates the only emergency homeless shelters in Collier County? St. Matthew's House provided more than 500,000 hot meals to those in need last year, and since 2010, 527 men and women have graduated from the St. Matthew's House Justin's Place Addiction Recovery Program. For over 30 years, St. Matthew's House has provided innovative solutions to fight homelessness, hunger, substance abuse, and poverty in Southwest Florida. And you can help St. Matthew's House in this life-transforming work by patronizing the St. Matthew's House thrift stores, Cafe M25, car wash and detailing center, and award-winning catering operations. For more information, visit stmatthewshouse.org. That's stmatthewshouse.org. St. Matthew's House is a 501c3 not-for-profit organization and does not solicit government funding.
Welcome back to the Bob Harden Show. And now here's your host, Bob Harden.
Thanks so much for joining us here on the show. We are dedicated to providing you news and commentary rooted in a commitment to individual liberty, personal responsibility, limited government, and the rule of law. Coming up, we're going to be visiting with Dave Beagle, the author of The Devil at Our Doorstep. Right now, we have with us William Yeatman, a research fellow at the Cato Institute. William, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on, Bob.
Always a pleasure. And William, tell us about the Cato Institute.
You bet. We're a think tank here in Washington, D.C., dedicated to advancing the ideals of a free society at every level of government.
Cato.org is the website, very robust website, Cato.org. So for these last several weeks, we've been talking about the saga of the infrastructure program. So maybe you could give us an update.
You bet. The saga continues. And so let me start with just some crucial context. And that is that there's $700 billion worth of infrastructure spending that is already in the works. Some of that is due to the pandemic stimulus that have been passed by Congress over the last year and a half. Hmm. Some of that is due to the periodic highway reauthorization that Congress is actually in the midst of right now. So $700 billion already baked in. On top of that, President Biden initially wanted $4 trillion worth of new spending, and much of that didn't have anything to do with infrastructure as it's traditionally understood. His current negotiating position is $1 trillion worth of new spending. That's the negotiating position in this ongoing saga. At first, his primary negotiating partner was West Virginia Senator Shelley Capito. But those talks broke down about 10 days ago, and his current negotiating partner is the so-called Group of Ten, five Democrats, five Republicans, the usual suspects, Romney, Manchin, et al., and also known, I guess, as the G10. Mm-hmm. But their proposal is $579 billion worth of new spending, paid for primarily by indexing the gas tax to inflation. I should note that his negotiating position is that the new spending ought to be paid for by an increase in corporate taxes. So that's where things stand right now. And in essence, the latest developments were 11 more senators have joined on to the G10 proposal, and Biden has given this effort until, I believe, next Friday to bear fruit. So we'll see. Noted on many prior calls, the odds-on favorite for what's going to happen ultimately, or odds-on favorite outcome, is that the talks break down and that Senator Schumer and Pelosi attempt to pass with their majorities using that reconciliation process everything under the sun. They attempt to get $4 to $6 trillion worth of new spending. That's where we stand now.
In fact, I think Schumer, if I'm not mistaken, he said basically even if we get some sort of bill that can pass, we're going to do it with a continuing resolution anyhow. In other words, reconciliation. Did I get that right? William, did I get that correct?
Oh, yes. I'm so sorry to interrupt you. I'm so eager to agree with you.
Yeah.
You're exactly right. So there was always sort of this devil's bargain lurking in the background, whereby Senator Schumer, in essence, was allowing these bipartisan talks to continue, but ultimately was going to try to ram through anything that wasn't gotten, from that $4 trillion starting point, any of that wasn't in the bipartisan bill, he would try to achieve through reconciliation. This process that allows them to win legislation with bare majorities and avoid the filibuster. There is a monkey wrench in that plan, however. Remember, in the Senate, it is 50-50. Mm-hmm. So the upshot is he would need every senator in his caucus and among centrists, and in particular West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, there is a great deal of unease at spending that much, that sort of money. So that the situation is fluid. It's not just I'll say this as well. Progressives. So a number of progressive senators, just to give your listeners an idea of how complex this dynamic is. But Senator Warren came out this week and said that she can't support the bipartisan bill, that she's not going to support any half measure.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it's a 50-50 in the Senate, and pleasing everyone is going to be a tough job for Senator Schumer. So but we'll see how this plays out. My two cents, I've noted it, I guess, the past two Fridays, and I echo what Senator Ron Johnson, Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson says, which is, my lord, for the last year and a half, Congress has spent $5.5 trillion. There's already $700 billion worth of infrastructure spending in the works. Isn't that enough?
Yeah.
I agree with Senator Johnson.
Yeah, trillion is the new billion, or billion is the new trillion, or whatever. It's just,
alas.
It's so strange. And in fact, I think Manchin has also declared not only will he not support the bill, but he won't support anything that's not bipartisan. So if he holds true to that, that basically means if they try to push it through with reconciliation, he's not going to support it.
That it's very difficult to prognosticate what Senator Manchin is thinking, but yes, no, he's put that pen to paper. He wrote that in actually a number of op-eds.
Yeah.
So you're exactly right. And look, I'm all for that outcome. You know, if no one is pleased to the extent that no bill passes,
yeah.
I think that's a fiscally responsible, outcome and one that's beneficial for the American people.
Absolutely. And you know what? Even with the coronavirus spending we've already had, there's billions and billions of dollars of waste so far. I mean, it's just incredible.
You hit the nail on the head with that. I guess it's a perfect segue. There's an alarming number of Inspector General and Government Accountability Office reports coming out indicating frightening waste when it comes to that $5.5 trillion worth of stimuli that's been passed in the last year and a half. And just to give your listeners some sort of idea of the performance of big government recently, so the unemployment insurance program, which is, I believe, ultimately authorized to spend about $900 billion. But according to the Inspector General, this is the phrasing he used, fraud is quote-unquote rampant, and indeed up to 27% in improper payments. That's of $900 billion.
Wow, that's a lot.
We're talking about $270-odd billion, and that's just in one program.
Yeah.
We're seeing the same thing with the Small Business Administration's, how they operated the Paycheck Protection Program. That's another trillion-dollar program with the Inspector General warning of improper payments up to 20%. So that's another $200 billion potentially in waste. And indeed, the Inspector General has identified another $77 billion in the Economic Injury Disaster Loan Program operated by SBA. The long and short of it is that I just basically broke down suspected improper payment rates due to fraud and bureaucratic incompetence at three programs whose total spending was about $2.5 trillion, of which we think $500 billion, a fifth of it, in essence, could be frittered out the door.
Yeah.
So to me, I think this is going to be a bigger and bigger story as more and more numbers come out, just how many hundreds of billions of dollars were wasted, as part of this rush to get it out the door, for all these pandemic stimuli that Congress has been passing. And right now the president and these centrist senators are haggling over about $500 billion worth of new spending in these infrastructure negotiations.
Unbelievable.
That's commensurate with what's been wasted. So that to me is shocking.
Yeah, William Yeatman, again, research fellow at the Cato Institute. As usual, we've run out of time before we run out of things to talk about, William, but I genuinely appreciate your commentary here on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Bob.
My pleasure indeed. Again, cato.org is the website. All right, coming up, Michael Cannon. He is the Health Studies Director at the Cato Institute. We're going to do that and more right here in the Bob Harden Show on the Bob Harden Broadcasting Network.
Stay tuned for more of the Bob Harden Show here on the Bob Harden Broadcasting Network.
Blue Provence Restaurant is a favorite dining destination for many Neapolitans, including Linda and myself. Blue Provence, located in a historic building in the heart of Old Naples at Creighton Cove, offers a mix of French bistro cooking with bold, fresh Floridian flavors. Experience award-winning cuisine at Blue Provence and enjoy one of Florida's most extensive, eclectic, and fun wine cellars. Dining your choice of the popular Eden Bar, the intimate Courtyard Garden, or the beautiful Provençal Caribbean Dining Room. Enjoy a wonderful and memorable evening in a casual and relaxed atmosphere that includes a taste of Provençal hospitality. Blue Provence is open 7 days a week, all year round. Visit BlueProvenceNaples.com for reservations, everyday specials, and coming events. That's BlueProvenceNaples.com or call 261-8239. That's 261-8239. Blue Provence, French restaurant in the heart of Old Naples.
Golf Shore Playhouse is passionately committed to enriching our cultural landscape by producing professional theater to the highest artistic standards and providing unique educational opportunities to folks in a spirit of service, adventure, and excitement. Over the past 15 years, the Playhouse has expanded immensely, outgrowing its current facilities. With dreams of expanding even further in order to better serve the community, broaden the economic impact, and strengthen the cultural fabric of our region, it's time to build and move into a new home. A 44,000-square-foot state-of-the-art theater and education center will be built on 3 acres at the corner of First Avenue South and Goodlett Frank Road, allowing Gulf Shore Playhouse to achieve those dreams. To find out more about Gulf Shore Playhouse, this state-of-the-art performing arts center, and about the season's exciting productions, visit GulfShorePlayhouse.org. That's GulfShorePlayhouse.org. We'll see you at the show.
Welcome back to the Bob Harden Show. And now here's your host, Bob Harden.
Thanks so much for joining us here on the show. It's brought to you in part by Choice Social, a new refreshing social networking platform. You can find out more by visiting choicesocial.us. Coming up, we're going to be visiting with Dave Bigelow, the author of The Devil at Our Doorstep. Right now, we have with us Michael Cannon, Director of Health Studies at the Cato Institute. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here, Bob.
Thank you, Michael. Hey, a big decision from the Supreme Court, 7-2, Obamacare stands. I thought we could visit a little bit about what the implications might be, the quality of the decision, what your thoughts might be, as well as what it means going forward with regard to health insurance.
Sure. So we were waiting for this decision for a long time. The court was hearing a case that originated in Texas, and in which a federal district court judge struck down the entire Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, struck down the entire law on the basis that, on the following basis. If you recall, back in 2012, you had a bunch of states, state attorneys general, and some individual plaintiffs saying that the individual mandate in Obamacare, this is the requirement that you buy a government-specified health insurance plan or pay a penalty to the IRS. They challenged that as unconstitutional, and 5 Supreme Court justices agreed that it was an unconstitutional use of the attempt to use the commerce power of the Constitution, Congress's power to regulate commerce. Mm-hmm. And so the court would have struck it down, except one of those 5 justices, Chief Justice John Roberts, said, but if we view that penalty as a tax instead of a penalty to enforce a mandate, then it would be constitutional, so I'm not going to strike it down.
Yeah.
Now, this was too clever by half, because Congress explicitly disavowed the use of the that it was using the taxing power and used the commerce power. And so what Roberts' decision did was actually gut the political constraints the Constitution imposes on Congress, and I can get into that.
But then fast forward to, that was 2012, fast forward to 2017, when Congress, remember, Republicans are controlling Congress, many of them want to repeal Obamacare, they don't have the votes to do it, but what they did have the votes to do is to zero out that mandate penalty so that it was still on the books, and the command to purchase health insurance is still on the books. But if you didn't obey that command, you would have to pay any money to the IRS.
Yeah. So my understanding
is... Attorneys General said... Go ahead, Bob.
No, my understanding is that they didn't say... basically said they just took it down to zero, right? Because they could always increase it to back up to a meaningful penalty, right? I think that was how it was done.
That is correct. That is correct. And if they wanted this case to succeed, Republicans shouldn't have zeroed out the penalty. They should have increased it dramatically. But Republicans never would have done that. And so we're left with what actually happened, which is some state attorneys general, Republicans, said, wait a second, under John Roberts' reasoning in that 2012 case, well, that reasoning no longer works because it's not a tax if it doesn't raise any money.
Mm-hmm.
And so they tried to challenge the mandate again using John Roberts' own reasoning against the law and say that since it no longer raises any money, it can no longer be seen as a use of the commerce power. We can only see it as a use of the commerce power, and therefore, under Robert's own reasoning, it must fall. They persuaded a lower court judge to buy that argument and strike down the entire law.
Hmm.
So the case made it all the way to the Supreme Court. There are a lot of funny things that happened along the way we could discuss, and a lot of people feared that. Supporters of Obamacare feared, oh my God, there's so many more Republican appointees on the court now that they're going to strike down the entire law. If you remember when Amy Coney Barrett was, the Senate was considering her nomination to the Supreme Court, a lot of Democrats were very worried that she would vote to overturn Obamacare and use this case to do it. What actually happened was 7 Supreme Court justices voted against this challenge, and only 2 voted for it.
My understanding, though, is
it included 5 Republican appointees.
My understanding, though, is that it's less based on the content of the law and more on standing. In other words, on process, on things that didn't have much to do with the case itself.
That's right, and I think they were correct to do that.
Yeah,
but even if they, so let's talk about standing for a second. In order to challenge a federal law or any act of the federal government in federal court, you have to have what we call standing, which means that action by the federal government has to injure you in a concrete and personal way.
Yep.
The Constitution requires that, or says that the federal courts only have the authority to hear actual cases and controversies. And that means, the courts have interpreted that to mean, it's only a case or controversy if what the government is doing injures you in some way. Otherwise, you don't get your day in court.
Yeah.
And what 7 Supreme Court justices said was, because this mandate no longer injures the plaintiffs, they didn't have standing in the first place.
There you go.
They basically said that the lower court should have tossed this out on day one and not wasted everybody's time, because this is not a case or controversy, and so the courts don't have any authority to hear it. Now, that was 7 judges, 7 justices, including 4 Republican appointees.
Yeah. So, Michael,
Clarence Thomas.
Yeah.
And including Clarence Thomas.
So basically,
to overturn the law in 2012.
So, Michael, I think what this demonstrates is that standing was a big deal in this case. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. I'm hopeful that next week when we visit, we could talk a little bit about what the implications might be for Obamacare and for the public going forward. But I really appreciate your comments on Obamacare and what this might mean for us. Michael, thank you so much for joining us here on the show.
Anytime.
All right. Thank you, Michael. Well, coming up, we're going to be visiting with Alexis Maciek. I'm hoping I'm pronouncing her name correctly. She's a research associate with the Heritage Foundation. We're going to talk about President Biden's first foray abroad. We're going to do that and more right here in the Bob Harden Show on the Bob Harden Broadcasting Network.
Stay tuned for more of The Bob Harden Show here on the Bob Harden Broadcasting Network.
Do you suffer from joint pain in your shoulders, hips, or knees? I was suffering from debilitating pain in my knees. On a referral, I saw Dr. George Markovich with the Institute for Orthopedic Surgery and Sports Medicine. He successfully treated my symptoms and pain for several months. Finally, having exhausted all alternatives for pain management, Dr. Markovich and I agreed that surgery was my best alternative. Dr. Markovich replaced both of my knees in 2006, and I now have full range of motion in both knees, and I have no pain. I now play golf and exercise free of debilitating pain in my knees. Don't suffer needlessly with joint pain. Call orthopedic surgeon Dr. George Markovich with the Institute for Orthopedic Surgery and Sports Medicine at 482-5399. That's 482-5399. He did a great job for me, and he'll help you too. You listen to The Bob Harden Show, so why not market your company to our loyal listeners? Ads are played live on each show and then archived so listeners can hear the show and your ad at their convenience. Each advertising package includes a banner on bobharden.com with a link to your website at no extra charge. Join Lulabee's Diner, Johnson's Air Conditioning, Blue Provence, and many others who advertise on the show. Call me at 598-3889, that's 598-3889, or send an email to bobharden@hotmail.com. to design an ad program that's just right for your business and your budget. You'll be pleasantly surprised at the cost and the value. Several advertisers have been with me for years. Find out why by calling 598-3889 or send me an email to bobharden@hotmail.com. You'll be glad you did.
Welcome back to the Bob Harden Show. And now here's your host, Bob Harden.
Thanks so much for joining us here on the show. It's brought to you in part by Gulf Shore Playhouse, bringing you professional New York-style theater at its very best. You can find out more by visiting gulfshoreplayhouse.org. Coming up, we're going to visit with Dave Bigo, the author of The Devil at Our Doorstep. Right now, we have with us Alexis Marachek. She is a research associate with the Heritage Foundation. Alexis, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thanks so much for having me on.
Really a pleasure, Alexis. And for our listeners that may not be familiar, it's hard to believe anybody wouldn't be, but tell us about the Heritage Foundation.
So the Heritage Foundation is a conservative think tank based in Washington, D.C. It's been around since the 70s. It had a huge part, played a huge role when President Ronald Reagan was in office. And we, we've been around almost 50 years now. And really, we make the make Capitol Hill our target audience, and we try to serve as an educational source and influence policy. That's just a little bit about us.
All right. So, and it's heritage.org, if I'm not mistaken.
So, yes, you've got it.
So, Alexis, President Biden made his first international foray and ending up with the Geneva summit, of course, the meeting between Putin and himself. I wanted to get your thoughts about that.
Yeah, so President Biden met with Vladimir Putin just a couple days ago in Geneva, Switzerland, for a summit. It lasted a couple of hours. And overall, President Biden brought up several issues with Putin, such as cyber attacks on United States infrastructure, also Ukraine in the context of Ukraine's territorial sovereignty and integrity. Also, he brought up human rights was a big issue, and then also Russia's involvement in Syria and Belarus as well. So there are a lot of different issues talked about. And I would say overall, President Biden brought up some good points at the summit, and I would say he spoke clearly, but it doesn't seem like there will be much fruit coming out of the summit.
Yeah, it looked like a photo op more than actually a productive meeting, quite frankly. So, I mean, and he said, what was puzzling to me, the president said, look, here's 16 things, 16 sectors that we don't want you to messing with when it comes to cyber warfare. You know, what concerns me is what's not on the list, and why would he single out what would be the hit list for cyber warfare?
I think it was important for President Biden to bring this up, saying that these 16 specific U.S. critical infrastructure entities must not be attacked by Russia. Of course, Putin was denying that the cyber attacks even happened in the past, such as the one on Colonial Pipeline or the one on JBS Foods, the meat processing company. But it was important that President Biden try to hold Putin accountable for these misdeeds. But that's really not enough in the grand scheme of things, because the U.S. needs to be bolstering its cyber defenses on our own front, and we need to take the Russian threat seriously.
Absolutely. Alexis, I mean, you know, actually, Putin, in his own press conference, said, look, yeah, first of all, the United States is the number one company when it comes to cyber warfare. Russia isn't even on the list. Those types of statements that Putin was making afterwards were just bald-faced lies, but the president didn't make any comments about that.
I agree. That was really purely propaganda that Putin was pumping out. I mean, even at Putin's press conference that he held on his own, it was really just denying certain things that Russia's done in the past, like its misdeeds. And it was just a way for Putin to get his propaganda across. So it is interesting. I think President Biden was on a little bit naive in the way, just in the way things went.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, you know, what would you have liked to have seen? What would have been the agenda in a perfect meeting with Putin? How would it have gone?
Honestly, I think the summit went pretty well for a summit. I think the main problem is that as long as Vladimir Putin is in the Kremlin, no summit with a U.S. president will be fruitful, because Putin cannot be trusted. He has been in power over Russia for about 21 years now. Mm. He has a track record of violating international norms. He's just not a trusted partner. And so I think that from a diplomacy standpoint, the summit went pretty well, as well as it could have. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that any summit with Putin will be fruitful.
Well, thanks for that point of view, Alexis. The one thing that was kind of interesting is that he signed off on the pipeline between Germany and Russia, which I don't know if that was a concession before the meeting or exactly what he was doing, but it made no, you know, pipeline here in the United States, he cuts it off, and they've been working on it for years, and approves that pipeline, which basically I think Trump actually stopped it. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so this actually happened a few weeks before the summit. President Biden decided to cancel U.S. sanctions on the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which is at least 95% completed, I believe. And this is a pipeline going from Russia under the sea and flowing, going to Germany. And it's set, I think, to be completed by the end of this year. And it was a terrible decision on President Biden's part to cancel these sanctions, because this is a huge security issue. This pipeline would also direct gas away from Ukraine, because right now Ukraine has these pipelines running through it, and it is able to profit from the gas industry. And so it's really a bad idea to redirect gas away from Ukraine, because it'll harm it economically. And that's not good, because we need to be supporting Ukraine.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Alexis, just taking a step back, how would you assess President Biden's foreign policy when it comes to, we've had the Geneva Senate, the NATO meeting, the G7? How's it looking to you so far?
I think it is positive that President Biden is wanting to strengthen our partnerships and our alliances again, because I think that suffered a little bit under the Trump administration, if I'm being quite honest. And so I think it's good that he has this diplomatic standpoint and he's wanting to rebuild our partnerships. But I think it's still too early to tell exactly what the Biden doctrine will be and what his foreign policy will look like, because we're not even 5 months into Biden's presidency. So, of course, we still have, you know, it's a 4-year term, so we still have a lot more time to figure out what his foreign policy will be.
Yeah, I mean, to me, my perception is he looks like a globalist, quite frankly, to me. I certainly appreciated President Trump's populism and his approach to make America great again. What I see with Biden, for example, is he immediately signs off on the Paris Accord. And, of course, I think I just have real questions about the reality or alternative energy sources. So just to me, it looks like he's caving in or at least wanting to say kumbaya with everybody in the world.
Yeah, I would have to agree with you. But I still think it's a little too early to draw big conclusions. But that does seem to be the trend going right now.
Yeah, Alexis Maraychek, again, a research associate with the Heritage Foundation. Heritage.org is the website. Alexis, I just genuinely appreciate your commentary here on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure indeed. All right, coming up. We're going to visit with Dave Bigo, the author of The Devil at Our Doorstep. I enjoy having Dave on the show because he talks about what's happening with the unions. He had a scuffle with the unions, union bosses from SEIU over the course of 2.5 years. They wanted him to sign a neutrality agreement. Sounds pretty benign, doesn't it? But it wasn't. It basically would have given permission to the union bosses to approach each and every one of his employees. And once they got to 50% plus one signed up for the union, they would be unionized. Dave said, look, you can unionize us if you want to, but you have to do it with secret ballot, not through intimidation tactics. Well, they wouldn't do that. They didn't want the secret ballot. So the process and dirty tricks ensued, and Dave prevailed. And he wrote a book about it. It's called The Devil at Our Doorstep. So I look forward to have Dave on the show. We'll be doing that and more right here on The Bob Harden Show on the Bob Harden Broadcasting Network.
Stay tuned for more of The Bob Harden Show here on the Bob Harden Broadcasting Network.
The dining scene in Naples is among the nation's finest. Get a first-hand experience with Naples Culinary Walks. Join a guided food walk with a terrific guide and a small group through elegant Naples neighborhoods known for destination restaurants. In 3 hours, you'll stop for small plates on your chosen tour. Dining walk choices include morning, afternoon, and evening offerings on 5th Avenue South, downtown 3rd Street, Waterside, Galleria Shops at Vanderbilt, and more. Prices begin at only $46 a person, depending on the tour you select. To find out more and to make a reservation, visit NaplesCulinaryWalks.com. That's NaplesCulinaryWalks.com for a great value and a terrific dining experience.
Do you have an extra auto you'd like to donate to charity? Maximize your tax deduction, support your favorite charity, and help a local child in need by calling Naples Auto Donation Center. Naples Auto Donation Center is a not-for-profit licensed car dealer. Just call NADC at 692-9840 and they'll take it from there. You get a properly documented tax deduction for whatever the vehicle actually sells for. Your designated beneficiary charity gets half the profit after fix-up costs, and the net revenue generated by NADC goes to Friends of Foster Children to provide tutoring and other enrichment activities for foster children the government doesn't provide. And NADC is also one of the few places in Collier County that sells inexpensive cars that actually run to folks who would otherwise not be able to afford one. It's a real win-win. Call Naples Auto Donation Center at 692-9840 or visit the website nadckids.com. You'll be glad you did.
Welcome back to the Bob Harden Show. And now here's your host, Bob Harden.
Thanks so much for joining us here on the show. It's brought to you in part by the Foundation for Government Accountability. I proudly serve on their board, creating policies and programs to get able-bodied folks off of welfare and back to work. It's a moral imperative, and you can find out more by visiting thefga.org. We have with us, as I mentioned before the break, Dave Bigo, the author of a great book. It's called The Devil at Our Doorstep. It chronicles all the things that happened over the course of 2.5 years as they attacked his business, his customers, his family, you name it. They pulled every trick in the book trying to get him to sign a neutrality agreement. He refused, but they finally slunk away like rats on a sinking ship 2.5 years later. Dave, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Bob, and thanks for talking about my book. I wish more people would buy it, but the media won't, talk about it at all because the unions control the media.
Yeah, no, there's no question about it. But you can't even make this stuff up. The dirty tricks that they play were just unbelievable, and it's right out of the Democrat playbook, quite frankly. So,
well, you know what it is? It's actually out of the union playbook that they indoctrinated the Democrats into, and it's the same thing we saw during the election process last year.
Yeah. So, I think what's going to happen is slowly but surely this net is closing. We're going to find out there was massive fraud in this election. It's going to start with what happens in Maricopa County, then we're going to end up going to Georgia, and the stuff that's going on there is just unbelievable, the things that are being uncovered. Wouldn't surprise me if we see a forensic audit in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan. I think it's all these dominoes are going to fall.
Yeah, I hope they overturn the election. I really do.
Yeah.
Because where we're headed under this administration is not good. And under the Trump administration, he did a lot of good things to protect this country and to improve our economy and jobs and things for people. And we need to get back to that. But if he becomes president again, he needs to be more professional in how he addresses stuff.
So, Dave, maybe any good scoop with what's going on with the unions right now?
Well, it's kind of interesting. The unions are really out there pushing hard right now, and they're pushing the Biden administration very hard to allow them to force union bias. People in that, and so Biden's changing the National Labor Relations Board around. You know, he's putting a guy in there, and a guy that will lead it, that is was a union boss back before, even though he was an attorney and he worked for the unions as an attorney. He was kind of a labor boss too, so he's putting people in there that's going to allow the unions to go out and try and force unionized people. And of course the PRO Act that he's trying to get passed too will do the same thing. And so that the unions can grow back again. And that's really, behind the scenes, has been pushed very hard.
Yeah. It makes me wonder though, if the rank and file is really supportive of Biden. I mean, you think about the Keystone Pipeline and the thousands of union jobs that were lost there. You can think back to the police unions and how they supported Trump. Kind of law and order. They didn't like what they were seeing in the Democrat Party. Wonder how the rank and file is really feeling about Biden.
Well, I think there's a lot of them that are not happy at all with what he's doing and him supporting some of these big unions, some of the more radical ones. And it's bad. And what's even funny, this is one I want to talk about. When you look at sports and the unions. You know, they control the Major League Baseball and basketball and football. And the Major League Baseball players, they're going after the union there. And the union's facing an all-star lawsuit for pulling the game out of Atlanta because the players are tired of what the union's doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad to see that... people are standing up for the right things and pushing back on people who are just trying to dominate this country.
Well, that's the news to me. I didn't realize that baseball players are pushing back on the union, the players union. So
yep.
That is so interesting to me. And typically, I mean, these are young guys, mainly not very well educated for the most part. And probably not too knowledgeable about the country or politics or anything of that nature. So I would imagine they kind of go along to get along. But that's so interesting that they're pushing back.
It really is. And, I hope they're successful in doing it because some of the UAW members, they're pushing back on the UAW bosses because of, things they've done to steal money, and all that kind of stuff. So I think people are waking up, and I think too, Bob, that just union people are waking up, but I think people are waking up across country, and people of different races, black people, white people are waking up to what's going on, and they're starting to step over to the conservative side. Which is great because that's what we got to get back to in this country.
Absolutely, I think that's absolutely true. I think the context of a presidential President Trump And then moving to Biden, who's all of a sudden the taxes are going up, inflation's going up, we're seeing jobs go away, all kinds of, you know, these are palpable things that really affect people's pocketbooks. I can't imagine, and of course Biden's support is reduced, I think, 6 percentage points, if I'm not mistaken, in the last couple of months. But there's real consequences for the type of policies trying to put in place.
Yes, there is, and Biden is being controlled by the left, and these steps are being put out there, and he just goes out and speaks about it. Well, he mumbles about it, mm-hmm. And he really doesn't know a lot of the details about stuff like that, and what's going on in this country is not good, and then what he's doing, with Russia and China and everybody else, it really bothers me what that could end up meaning to this country.
Yeah, I agree with that, Dave. Well, I just genuinely appreciate your book. I mean, the fact of the matter is I encourage our listeners to read The Devil at Our Doorstep. There's a website, thedevilatourdoorstep.com. You can get a copy of the book on my website at bobharden.com at a nice discount, by the way. But no matter how you get it, you should read the book because it's extremely informative. I mean, using the clergy, using kids, Halloween, you name it, the union bosses making false accusations to the National Labor Relations Board, that it's front page news when it happens, but when they retract it and they realize it's not going anywhere, it's back page, small print. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it is. And it's interesting. Last night, my wife and I belong to a group called Legatus. It's a Catholic CEO organization. And we have a get together third Thursday of every month, and we usually go to Mass, but then we go to a country club and have dinner and a speaker and stuff like that. And
nice.
But the priest that said Mass last night, he's actually in my book, in chapter 13, I believe it is. He's Monsignor Schadel. And when the union started using clergy people against us, he really stepped up and he gathered all the clergy people, and from different religions all over the city here in Indianapolis, and got them in a meeting and set them down and woke their eyes up to what was really going on, which was great.
Yeah, kudos to him. Well, again, I just encourage our listeners to go to thedevilatourdoorstep.com, get a copy of the book, The Devil at Our Doorstep. It's a great read. Dave, always host well-informed commentary here on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks, and have a great weekend.
You as
and
well.
All your listeners have a great weekend, too.
Thank you, Dave. Well, that's a wrap here on today's show. I hope you enjoyed it. I certainly had fun. Learned a lot, actually. And on Monday, we're going to visit with Mark Shulman, as we always do on Monday morning. He's the founder and publisher of HistoryCentral.com. We'll be talking about global events, current global events. Larry Reed is the president emeritus of the Foundation for Economic Education. We're going to be talking about paradise, about these different communes that have been formed in the United States in our history. It's so interesting to see how they've not played out so well when it comes to communism. And we'll visit with Larry Bell. He's a endowed professor at the University of Houston in space architecture and the author of several books. His latest is What Makes Humans Truly Extraordinary, Exceptional. Larry will be joining us as well. Always appreciate your comments on the show. You can send me an email at bobharden@hotmail.com. bobharden@hotmail.com. I hope you make it a great day on the Paradise Coast. And great weekend as well, and Juneteenth as well. Hope namaste.
Thanks so much for listening to The Bob Harden Show on the Bob Harden Broadcasting Network. For more information and audio files of previous shows, visit www.bobharden.com.